Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and gastronaut. Today, we're looking at fermentation and humans' long-standing fascination with it. Fermented products are all over the shop at the moment. Kimchi, kefir, kombucha are all on the up. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. The truly interesting fact is something like a third of all food consumed by humans is fermented. Fermentation is used in the making of pickles, olives, bread, beer, wine, chocolate, coffee, vinegar, soy sauce. And of course, we've been doing all this for thousands of years. But the question is, why? Why do humans ferment their food? Well, I want to explore fermentation methods and find out what today's food innovators are taking from this ancient tradition. And with me to explore this are two absolutely fabulous guests. We have Eve Kalanick, a nutritional therapist, podcaster and author, writing on the subjects of food, nutrition and well-being. Hello there, Eve.
Hello. Lovely to be here.
Brilliant to have you with us. We've also got Simon Poffley, writer and founder of The Fermentarium, an independent organisation dedicated to promoting the small-scale production of real fermented food and drink. Hello there, Simon.
Hello, hi.
Brilliant to have you as well. Now, before we get into all of this, let's first discover your favourite fermented food or drink. So, Eve, perhaps you first. If you could have anything from anywhere in the world or any time of the world, what do you think is fascinating, surprising and delicious?
Well, I was going to say red wine, but I don't think that's where we want to go on this podcast, to be honest with you. But no, my father is actually of Polish descent. So I think he would probably string me up if I didn't say it was sauerkraut. That being said, because I've actually been working on a collaborative project with a brand called Cultjar, we've been creating some different ferments and I've been experimenting with my own flavours. And so I really love the spicy cauliflower that we've created that's got turmeric in it and nigella and some red onions and garlic in there. They also introduced me to curtido, which is a Salvadorian type of slaw. So I've been really enjoying that. So there's a couple of different ones in there, but I have to say, I really do have to say sauerkraut if I'm picking one.
Which goes very well with red wine, really, doesn't it? So let's face
it,
it's pretty good.
Yeah. And cheese. So, yeah.
And everything. Simon, how about you? If you had to choose one fermented food product, food or a drink?
Well, I mean, it's always hard to choose just one, but maybe for a drink, I'd go for a boza, which is...
What's that?
Maybe people haven't heard so much about it, although it's been going for thousands of years. You can still buy it commercially in places like Turkey and across the Balkans. It's made with a different type of grain in different places. Traditionally, it's usually millet or maybe sort of crack wheat or something. And you use like a starter culture, which is sort of passed on and stuff. But I mean, it'd be a drink that people would recognize from 3,000 years ago. There's not much has changed to it. And in fact, it's like one of the precursors of what we know today as beer.
So, and is it alcoholic?
Yeah, but only sort of slightly. So maybe because it's got lots of other things going on in there. So maybe like 1-2% or something usually. I mean, it depends how you sort of ferment it. You can get the alcohol up if you so wished. But it is.
Yeah. Session beer.
Yeah,
but
really. I mean, it is sold as a soft drink, which is enjoyed by children and people and stuff. So, but it's got so many sort of unusual...
That'd keep them asleep at night, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's got so many sort of unusual sort of flavour tones to it. It's sort of and to be drinking something which people would recognise from thousands of years ago. I mean, it's if you do it at home, you'd just be doing it pretty much the same way as in ancient Sumeria. So it's...
Excellent. And this is boza, is that right?
Boza, that's right. B-O-Z-A, usually.
It's marketable already. I like it.
Yeah, you might find it in a Turkish shop if you're lucky. You could always ask for it. People might know about it.
Yeah. So I spent a fair bit of time filming documentaries in refugee camps. And wherever you go, even in refugee camps where people are living on World Food Programme rations, people will always take a little chunk of it aside and will brew. And so you walk around refugee camps and there's always somebody with a bucket of fermenting stuff, whether it's the local grain or some sort of carb, and making beer. It's one of those things that everyone is drawn to from whatever whatever your circumstances are. I think that's what's extraordinary about it. So, Simon, fermented food appears in every part of the world, every food culture, and as I say, whether people are poor or rich. Why is that? Why is it so commonplace?
Well, I mean, it probably goes back a really long way to even before they were humans. Our forebears were arboreal. They sort of lived in trees before we even got to the sort of monkey stage and stuff. And those sort of our forebears, they would have come down onto the sort of the forest floor to collect things like sort of fruit which had fallen. And fruit which falls and sort of stays on the ground becomes sweet and becomes alcoholic. It goes through a fermentation. And there's quite a few theories about that. The reason that sort of our forebears actually left the forest was because of this fruit which had fermented and turned into alcohol. It sort of gave a hit. It was part of the process of hardwiring the brain, which we have today, along with other things, maybe like sort of wild mushrooms and magic mushrooms and things. So it had like an effect on the sort of psyche, and it's because it gave a kick to the sort of the system. And so even when people started sort of collecting things, it wasn't just about making bread, it was also about making alcohol, making beer to sort of sustain people. And also in fermented foods, in a lot of cultures, they're sort of like a condiment which adds flavor to things. So if a staple was just sort of grass seeds and stuff, it would be quite boring to eat. But if you've got something which is lively, sort of got some sort of sourness or some other sort of flavor to it, it helps people to take on board more calories because they mix it in with a food which has no flavor, and then they consume more and sort of build up strength and sort of survive. So yeah, I mean, there's probably multiple reasons, but
yeah. And in terms of preserving food, was that important, or was it really more about flavor?
Well, no, that was hugely important for things like sort of dairy products, milk. That would sort of become rancid after a few days. There was no refrigeration. So the only way to sort of preserve milk in quantity was to put it through like a fermentation process where it would be going to a state where it could be kept for a longer period. And things like sort of vegetables like a cabbage, if you just sort of cut a sort of green vegetable like that and you left it, it would just go turn sort of black, mouldy, and would be unedible after a few days, however you stored it. Whereas if it's been fermented, it will last all through winter. And so it was a way for people to sort of keep food stocks up during the sort of cold, lean months when nothing was growing. So preservation was definitely part of it, yeah.
Yeah, so we're making a distinction between fermentation and rotting here. So, let's get to the basics of the chemistry in a culinary sense. What is fermentation? What's the process?
Well, it's the work of different microbes. Usually it's an anaerobic process, which means without oxygen. For instance, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is a brewer's yeast, which we use for sort of making bread, that sort of goes into a process where it turns the sort of substrates, it turns all the sort of carbohydrates, the sugars, into alcohol and carbon dioxide. With lactic bacilli, that eats through things and creates sourness, it might create lactic acid, and acetic bacteria will create acetic acid. The process changes whatever is being fermented into different things, into different compounds. So the flavours change, textures change, the amount of vitamins and things might change as well.
Yeah, and it's not bacteria, it's also moulds, fungi, yeasts, lots of different microbes involved in the process.
Exactly, yeah. So moulds, definitely. I mean, so, yeah.
Very good. Okay. Well, Eve, fermented foods have historically had a close association with health, and that's certainly the perception today. It's suggested that they can help not just our digestion, but relieve all sorts of medical conditions. But how much do we actually know? Well, because there's a lot of chat about this, but what research is out there that we can really depend on?
Well, yeah, I think we need to be careful not to make quite outlandish health claims, really, because I don't believe that any one particular type of food is a panacea for health and well-being. Like, we have to take that in the context of our overall diet and our lifestyle as well, because those actually impact on how healthy we are. The research is relatively sparse, but I think it is gaining a lot more traction because there has been more of an interest in fermented foods generally. But I also think we need to acknowledge that, and Simon kind of has obviously talked about the history behind this, is that fermented foods have been a time-honoured part of ancestral eating, and we've simply evolved to eat and reap the benefits from fermented food. So part of that was obviously to preservation is something that is much of a, you know, it's really ingrained in this. But I think over time, our ancestors realized that it improved digestibility of the foods, increased the texture and the flavor. And now we have the more sophisticated techniques whereby we can actually really investigate what's actually in these foods. And it shows us that there's all these beneficial microbes, including the bacteria and yeast that we just talked about. So yeah, the health associations have largely been associated with gut, the gut and the gut microbiome. But as we're exploring more about what the gut actually does, then you see that secondary health benefits in terms of our immune system functioning, because most of our immune system is located and managed in our gut. The gut-brain connection is a whole subset of gut health that's gaining a lot more traction recently, and its association with the composition of our microbiome and how that links into mood disorders like depression and anxiety, for instance, and even metabolic health. So the second association with our gut health is a lot of those other systems in our body. But I just think we have to be really careful about, you know, sauerkraut is going to not necessarily make you like cure your depression necessarily, but I think in a greater context alongside other tools and things like that, I definitely think it does have a place. And the research, like I said, it is becoming more, I mean, there's a lot more research coming out now about it.
Yeah. Now, we've mentioned a whole bunch of different products or forms of food and fermented products during the introduction. So we were talking about kimchi, kefir and kombucha. Now, do you draw a big distinction between the products which are live, they're still fermenting, they have live bacteria or microbes, whatever it might have been that was the fermentation tool, and things like bread and chocolate, which are kind of effectively inert, they're no longer going through a process. Is there a major distinction between these two sides of products?
I think that's really important to say that, is that fermented foods all have different roles to play, really. So in the case of something like a sourdough, for instance, there's not going to be, or very little amounts of the actual microbes left in there, but what sourdough does is it acts as a prebiotic. So it's pre-digested initially, and then it acts as a prebiotic. So that means feeding the microbes that are in our gut. So in that instance, it does have a slightly different role versus, say, a lacto-fermented vegetable like a kimchi or a sauerkraut or whatever, where the bugs are still essentially live. You know, also even taking things a step further, if you take a supermarket, say yogurt or something like that, that's been pasteurized, that's going to be very different to the one that you've cultured at home, which will have much more in way of diversity of strains and numbers. But I think that these different fermented foods have different roles to play. So in the case of, yeah, that bread association, it's more that it has this prebiotic feeding effect rather than us ingesting the live microbes. Also with bread as well, I mean, most supermarket loaves on the shelves are just dead of any nutritional value anyway. I mean, the fiber content is so low in them and they've been heavily processed. So what I'm talking about specifically now is properly fermented bread like sourdough that we've been making up until about the 1980s, and then the Chorleywood method came in, which basically sped up that fermentation process. So I'm not comparing properly traditionally fermented sourdough with, say, the generic supermarket loaves. I think that's really important, because also, you know, there are a lot of commercial sourdough loaves now on the supermarket shelves, and I think that's just marketing hoodwinking a bit.
Yeah, a little bit of flavour rather than kind of depth to it. Okay, so Simon, we've been fermenting food and drink for thousands of years, but can you draw out from that any particular historic landmarks?
When we talk about historic landmarks in fermenting, it's usually a bad thing. I think Eve mentioned the Chorleywood bread process. So, I mean, for tens of, you know, for thousands of years, people have been making bread. And the first bread probably was sort of unleavened, because it was just like crushed grass seeds, which were sort of cooked on a sort of open fire, or maybe on a stone or something. And it would have been really hard. It would have been damaging for the teeth, and it would have been sort of something not so pleasurable to eat. But if the fire went out and the paste was left, from the grains and the water. The next day, the fermentation process probably would have begun, especially if it was warm, and there'd be some sort of rise in it. When that new, the fire was lit again and sort of the paste was baked, the bread would have risen a bit and it'd been much more edible. And so that's how bread began and sort of carried on. But one of the big changes in Britain was in the 1860s, 1880s, a guy sort of came up with a new process of making bread by not actually fermenting it, just by adding water, which had been pumped full of carbon dioxide. And he created the ABC tea rooms, which were all over and a big part of sort of a British culture. Yeah, and he sort of said, oh, yeah, and then we don't want people sort of kneading bread with their hands. It's all very dirty and stuff. And then sort of in the 1960s, the Chorley Woods process came in, and that did sort of change the way how bread was made. So now 80% of bread is produced by that method. It's not really got much nutritional value. It's all soft and squidgy and packed in plastic. And so when something major happens, like some historic landmark, it's usually an act of convenience. We can see that with kefir production as well. So kefir would have been produced the same way for hundreds, if not thousands of years. But now there's a new industrial process of making it where you don't actually use the grains. You just use like a freeze-dried sample of a few of the different microbes which might be present in one variety of kefir. So it becomes like a mass product which can be sold everywhere but doesn't actually bear much relation to the original.
And there's, I mean, let's talk about other fermentation methods. I make my own salami, and the first kind of first 48 hours is a fermentation stage where you're hoping that these flavors develop, because I don't do it every single day, I'm just hoping my fingers are crossed a little bit. If you do it all the time, then I guess you get a sense of how it all works. What other methods are there out there of kicking off fermentation?
Yeah, I love it. It can be just sort of spontaneous. I mean, the traditional way for making cider would be just to sort of crush the apples, extract the juice, and then just put it in the vat and leave it. I know a cider maker here, and he just sort of fills up these huge containers in the garden and leaves it, and it just sort of does its job. Of course, the sort of a modern process would be to chuck in some sort of sulfites or something to kill off everything which is live, and then add a sort of a commercial yeast to it, which you might get sort of more consistent results, but you wouldn't get the sort of difference and sort of a variety of flavors that you would from using the sort of natural yeasts. So it's sort of risky, sort of using sometimes the old methods, but you don't actually need to do anything. You can just rely on the microbes which are present in the air about us. So that's one way. Another popular method is, it hasn't got a very good name, a back slopping.
Ah, yes.
So, and this is the way most yogurt would have been made for hundreds of years. People had these things which are called heirloom yogurts. So they'd be passed down from generation to generation in the Scandinavian.
Like vinegar mothers.
Exactly, yeah. And so when the sort of a daughter got married, it'd be a sample would be given to her to pass it on and to take it into her family and use it. And because they're at room temperature, you just you make your yogurt, you leave like a half a cup, and then you put that in with fresh milk and mix that up, and then that will create the next batch. So it's like a way of sort of a back slopping, you just add in a bit which remains. That method works,
which is very much like sort of keeping a sourdough starter.
It is,
I suppose,
yeah, well, yeah, it? Exactly, yeah. So yeah, I mean, that would be something which families would better sort of do at home without refrigeration. So it's a way of keeping things going, but it also kept a connection as well. So in America, there's a sourdough library which has got samples from people who got their sourdough starters, which maybe were created by their great grandparents, or so it's been passed down generation to generation. So it's one way of sort of actually possibly improving not just the health of a person, but the health of their grandchildren, by who haven't yet been born, by sort of inculcating the sort of desire of a sort of a knowledge of how to do something like that and to, how to pass it on. It becomes part of the family in a way. Yeah.
And this binds cultures and societies together, doesn't it? So one of my, the weirdest thing I've ever eaten in my life, I think, is rotten walrus. I was filming up in the Arctic with an amazing group of Inuit hunters. And one evening before we left, they said, right, party time, come around the house. And and one of them nipped outside, dug up this large hunk of walrus and brought it in the house and chucked it on the floor. And it was just lit, you know, there was no art to it. There was a huge amount of culture and history, but literally it had been wrapped in some plastic and buried, and that was it. And this was 6 months later. We dug it up and ate it, and had the I think I had a bit of the liver, which was challenging. Is the word I would use for it.
Yeah, that's going to be punchy.
Oh yeah. Is it weirdly not as bad as surströmming, which is possibly one of the most revolting substances on the planet, which is fermented herring, and it ferments in the can, and then the can sort of, you know, busts open.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the bad side. We're trying to stick with the good side. So let's look at what this actually does for us. What are the positives, Eve? So let's look at the gut microbiome. You know, our guts have got a whole galaxy of bacteria in them already. Is this where we should look for the health benefits of fermented foods in supporting or changing our gut bacteria?
Well, I do think that fermented foods have largely been associated with their positive impact on our gut and our gut microbiome. But as I mentioned before, there's the knock-on effect to all the other systems that our gut intrinsically has a role to play in. So there's a knock-on effect there. But what I do think is that, you know, fermented foods are kind of the perfect symbiosis of us and microbes. And it comes back to what Simon was saying about that kind of ancestral connection that we're passing down through families and things like this. But I think in the realm of gut health, and obviously that's my specialised area, is that a lot of people are keen to take things like probiotic supplements, for instance, that you might get in your chemist or health food shop. But if you look at fermented foods, particularly that I'm talking about the live ferment, so things like, it could be a yogurt that you're making from home, or a milk kefir or whatever, or the lacto fermented vegetables in particular, is that they contain much more in terms of diversity in the strains that they contain versus, say, the probiotic supplements, because they, you know, a lot of those strains in the probiotic supplements are the same 12 strains. Not every probiotic supplement's going to contain them. So when you're looking at, you know, live fermented foods, you're talking, you could have up to sort of 30 strains, for instance, and the number that's contained in just kind of one spoonful of a fermented food is infinitely higher. So there's that. And also, when you take a probiotic supplement, a lot of the microbes in there are essentially dead, whereas the ones that you're ingesting through the fermented foods are live. So with the lacto ferments, and I'm just going to use them in particular to kind of further this point, is that they are also very high in fiber and polyphenols, and these are special plant chemicals that we know have a positive impact on our gut health and stimulate our microbes to produce a lot of things called postbiotics, which are things like the short chain fatty acids that help us to manage inflammation, help us to balance blood sugar levels, and even things like neurotransmitters like serotonin. I think people are still massively shocked to know that 95% of our overall serotonin production is in our gut and not in our brain. So there's a whole host of these chemicals that our microbes produce. And, you know, these lacto-fermented vegetables are a really high concentrated source of fiber and polyphenols. So there is this kind of double effect with those types of fermented foods, where you're getting that feeding of the existing microbiome, but also you're ingesting some of these beneficial microbes that seemingly have a transient positive effect on our microbiome as well. So it's just really important, I think, for people when they're talking about gut health and ferments, to just understand about why that happens. And in the case of something like a kimchi or the curtido that I mentioned, or a lot of the fermented vegetables, you know, sometimes there's up to kind of like 8 to 10 different types of plants in each of those foods. So when you take a spoonful of that, you're also enhancing the diversity of the plants that you're taking in through our diet. And I think that's a key thing that a lot of people struggle with now, is lack of diversity in terms of the plants, foods that they're taking in. So yeah, I think that association with our microbiome is the kind of real symbiosis of fermented foods and our microbes that we've just kind of lost touch with, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of the chemistry of this, Simon, when did we actually learn what was going on during fermentation? You know, I presume at some level people just did things and it turned into something else and it worked. When did we actually get to grips with the function of bacteria and yeasts and molds and fungi?
Well, only very recently, really. I mean, for thousands of years, people didn't really understand what was happening at all, because there were no microscopes. There was no way of seeing what a yeast or a microbe of any sort was, because they're just too small. So when Germany brought in the sort of Reinheitsgebot for sort of a cleanliness, well, sort of the sort of law about what could be used in beer production, it didn't actually mention yeast, and that was in the 1800s, because yeast wasn't understood to be part of beer. So when people made beer in Britain or something, or in the old days, they'd just have some sticks which they'd dip into the yeast at the top of a container and dry it out and then add it to the next batch. And that would sort of rehydrate the yeast cells. But people didn't really know what it was. And the meaning of the word yeast, it sort of comes from meaning to rise, but no one actually sort of knew anything about it. It's probably not till Louis Pasteur in the 1860s, 1850s or something, studied under a microscope and discovered sort of microbes which we know as yeasts. And he looked at various problems of the wine industry and all the things which are going on. And it was from his methods which the idea of how to sort of pasteurize, the whole idea of pasteurization comes from his work.
That fundamentally changed food production, didn't it?
It did, yeah. I mean, at first, because the wine industry, for instance, was having problems of infections of wild yeast. And so he discovered that if you heated up wine to 60 degrees for a certain amount of time, it would kill everything off. I mean, it would also kill off the flavour. So that isn't actually done anymore, but it's still done with food. So you can buy things like sauerkraut in supermarkets, which we'll say it's, you know, got cabbage in it, but might have actually gone through a pasteurization process, because it's a way of lengthening shelf life. So, yeah, I mean, it's not what we want to sort of, pasteur's got a bit of a bad name, because when you talk about something which has been pasteurized, you think of sort of cardboard flavors, you think of sort of things which aren't so good. After that, I mean, other people developed the work. There was a particular Russian immunologist, Eli Metchnikoff, who in sort of the early 1900s was looking at yogurt, especially in the sort of Caucasus in the mountains, because there were lots of
centenarians.
Okay. They're like 100 years old, and he was trying to work out how they were sort of living so long. And he discovered that part of it was the sort of they were eating all this yogurt, and so he was trying to sort of see what was in it. And he discovered there was lactic bacteria which were creating lactic acid. From his work, it was discovered that that has a very positive effect. So, I mean, he was perhaps one of the sort of modern day sort of from his work comes the idea of a microbiome, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and Eve, I mean, we've talked a lot about the positive sides of fermented food, but is it all good for us? Are there fermented foods to avoid?
Well, the short answer, I think, to that is yes, it is all good for us. I think that the fear around it is more this general kind of hygiene hypothesis of everything has to be sterilized for it to be deemed, you know, safe and healthy. So I think there's just a way we need to kind of rethink around that. Obviously, there are some situations where it is contraindicated. And of course, if you've got any, you know, concerns around that, you should like definitely check. But they, you know, generally, they're quite few and far between. For most of us, I'd say rather than avoiding it, I'd be like, actually, we need to actively add in some of these fermented foods daily into our diet. Because I also think there's an issue with us you know, we're so disconnected from our food. We buy heavily sterilized food that's full of in plastic, that's full of preservatives and emulsifiers and all these other chemicals that have a negative impact on our gut health. And actually, we don't do anything tangibly to counterbalance that. And we do have this disconnect with our food. And that's why I'm a big proponent of people trying to ferment some of their, I mean, okay, fine, you know, there's convenience and stuff like that. But honestly, like, it's mostly the microbes are doing most of the work. We're not doing it. So I would suggest, like, people do some ferments, some simple ferments at home, because it's allowing them to connect back to their food and connect back to the soil. And ultimately, that's about how we kind of can start to reconnect about what's happening in our bodies on a day-to-day basis. I would say there's some caveats on in terms of ferments that are in the supermarket. So, for instance, things like kombucha is really popular now. And I see a lot of my clients who quite virtuously go to me, oh, I don't drink fizzy drinks, but I'm drinking like gallons of kombucha. And I'm like, yeah, but fine. If you're drinking a lot of that stuff that's actually been quite heavily filtered and they use a lot of sugar because it's more palatable for our Western palate, and they're just consuming it. There is actually quite, you know, overall, they might be consuming more sugar than they would do if they were, you know, drinking generic fizzy drinks. So I just think
the fruit juice argument kicks in as well.
Kind of, do you know what I mean? But but I'm talking about, like I said, like more commercially available ones that have been indoctrined slightly for our, or quite heavily for our palate. But in general, I think it's more about how do we actively add them in to our diet and start to reconnect in that way to our food.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about flavour, Simon, because it's often fermentation's sort of flavour compounds that are interesting and that we notice first. And, you know, MSG is made from fermented molasses, amongst other things, I guess. You know, fermentation as a flavour enhancer, is this the important part of it, do you think?
To a big extent. I mean, like some of the products you mentioned at the beginning, chocolate. I mean, that would just, cocoa beans would have no flavour, they'd be insipid and just, you wouldn't want to eat them. It's the fermentation process which changes the quality of the beans. Same with coffee and same with another product, vanilla. That wouldn't exist without fermentation either. And as for beer, wine, and sort of a, it does a lot to sort of change the process and sort of bread as well. I mean, flavour is very important. It makes us want to sort of try things and eat things and sort of it attracts people to it and sort of it makes people sort of seek out new flavours. So it's part of the experience. No one would want to sort of sit down and eat food or drink which had no flavour whatsoever. So but to produce a huge range of flavours. So things like beer, I mean, there was a point where beer became pasteurised and was sort of very bland, but there's been a huge move back to using different microbes, not just beer yeast, but using things like Breton amici's, which is like a wild British yeast which used to live in the rafters of old breweries. And would give like the flavour notes for that are things like horse blanket, which doesn't sound too good, but funky, the funkiness of that.
I quite like the idea of tasting a bit of horse blanket myself.
Visited some nomads in a sort of a yurt in Uzbekistan, and they gave me some fermented mare's milk, and it was really challenging. Because I wasn't used to it. I'd been brought up on nice, you know, sort of pasteurized milk. For me to sort of drink something which had little things like butyric acid in it, which is, you know, again, great for your gut. It was quite a sort of revelation. I mean, you need to sort of find the funky side to sort of experience those new things. And I think Eve's right. It's so good to make things at home because the big thing which you're really changing there is instead of being a consumer, you become a producer. And as soon as you become a producer, it opens your eyes to a whole new world. You see everything in a different light. So if you make a good sourdough bread, you're not going to want to put pasteurized cheese on it. You're not going to want to smear it with sort of some sort of dead product. You're going to want to look for new things. And maybe you think, oh, well, maybe I should get organic flour, or maybe I should look for sunflower seeds, which have been grown locally or something. And then when you travel, you sort of go to bakeries or you find grandmothers who are still making things by the old methods. It sort of connects you to new people and to sort of new experiences, becoming part of the food world by becoming a producer is perhaps one of the best things you can do for yourself, not just socially, but health-wise.
Yeah. When you start making yourself, you care more and eat better, don't you? It's as simple as that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It has multiple beneficial effects.
Yeah. Okay, so Eve, this podcast is aimed at the food industry, and I'm interested in the fact that in the UK, fermented foods have become much more popular. But what opportunities does that open up for food and drink producers? Because there are more people wanting these things, but are there things that haven't been explored yet, products that you're surprised haven't been developed yet?
I don't know if there's products. I mean, I don't. Yeah, that's a hard one to answer, really. I mean, I do think that the popularization of fermented foods has come largely from, well, twofold, really. One is that I think there's been a return to sort of wanting to eat more ancestrally. And I think that's been reflected in the restaurant industry, where they're using like the less popular cuts of meat and offal and things like that. And you can see fermented foods in a lot of the bigger restaurants now as well. And I also think it is because people are, or the area of gut health is getting a lot more attention. I mean, it's massively expanded over the last three decades, and continues to gain traction. But in terms of opportunities, I mean, there's part of me that thinks, yes, okay, it'd be great to get more fermented foods in the supermarket, because obviously you're broadening the reach of people. But I just think these things are just so subject to like marketing and shortcuts. It's a bit like the sourdough conversation that we were just having. And there's most of the supermarket sourdoughs are actually fake sourdoughs. So I think there's a fine line in fermented foods being more widely available, which gives a greater awareness for people, and then the ones that actually are the true reflection of that. And I don't know, I think that's kind of it's a difficult one to kind of get your head around, really.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, now final question for both of you. What's next in fermented foods? Is it a question of, for you, Simon, do you want people to look back to history, or to slow down and to make small batch products? Or do you think there's something new that we have yet to discover and you'd like to see people research?
Well, I mean, there's always new frontiers. One thing is for me would be sort of to look to maybe other places where we haven't looked before. So somewhere like Africa, huge continent, but a lot of fermented products from that continent haven't really sort of seen much daylight in over here. So there's lots of fermentation of different grains and different root vegetables and stuff, which would be good to experiment with and stuff. But also, if you go down the science routes, there's a very interesting article last week by George Monbiot about precision fermentation, where you actually use fermentation processes to actually create new types of protein and stuff, which could have a huge effect on the way that agriculture is run today. So certainly not just looking at traditional methods, but looking at sort of new scientific methods of doing things. There's probably a lot which can be learned through that as well.
Yeah. And Eve, I mean, is there an area of research that you would like to see being expanded, or is there a product you'd like to see on the shelves that isn't there now?
Well, I think the main thing for me would be to just see more papers on this, really, to just kind of affirm what our ancestors knew, so that you can basically put a finger up to the naysayers. So I think it would be good to see some more of that. But I just like people to really just start trying to do some ferments themselves, because for me it's about connection with your food. I see it in time and time again in my practice, and there is that, as I said, that constant disconnect. And I think it's about more regular consumption with these things. You're not going to have a jar of sauerkraut and then have epiphany the next day. It's about how do we build these things consistently into our routine. So for me it's a double thing. It's more the science papers side of it, but then also I would love to see people bringing it in and making it just more familiar with the process of doing it.
Yeah, familiarity sounds like a great idea. Well, Eve Kalanick and Simon Poffley, that was absolutely fascinating and fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to seeing the expansion of the fermented food industry and see what happens next. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Now, did you know Food Matters Live is launching a digital publication in April with exclusive content all about careers in the food and drink industry? It'll shine a light on the fascinating career options available with inspiring talks, podcasts, and of course, job listings. You can sign up to receive it, or if you're a company, register to become a partner by searching Food Matters Live Digital Publications. Thank you so much for listening.